As we continue our study of the life of Christ according to Luke. Luke tells us, behold, there was a man named Joseph. He tells us that this man was a counselor. By that, he is declaring that he was one of the members of the religious ruling body known as the Sanhedrin. He was a good man, and he was just. Because he was just, he did not consent to the decision of the council concerning Jesus. Verse 51, the same had not consented to the council and the deed of them. The Greek text would indicate that he abstained from voting on the issue of Jesus. We are told that he was from Arimathea. Now, Arimathea was the city of Ramah that was in Ephraim, which was the birthplace of the prophet Samuel. Matthew's gospel tells us that he was rich and that he was a disciple of Jesus. John's gospel tells us that he was a secret disciple for fear of the Jews. It had been determined that if any of the members of the Sanhedrin would acknowledge that Jesus was the Messiah, that they would be put out of the Sanhedrin. They would lose their position. So he was a secret believer, as were many of the priests. They believed upon Jesus secretly, but did not make an open profession of their faith because of the determination that anyone that would be excommunicated. Mark tells us that he was an honorable counselor. Luke here tells us that he was waiting for the kingdom of God. That is, he believed in the promises that God would send the Messiah. And he was waiting for the Messiah to come and to establish the kingdom of God. Now, legend, one of the early church legends, tells us that Joseph of Arimathea was sent by Philip to take the gospel to England in the year 61, and that he went to Glastonbury. And when he came to Glastonbury, he brought with him the silver chalice that Jesus used with his disciples at the Last Supper. This silver chalice became known as the Holy Grail. And the Knights of Sir Arthur, or King Arthur, were always dreaming that they might find that Holy Grail. According to the legend, when he arrived in Glastonbury, he was very tired, and he leaned upon his staff, and as he did, his staff was pressed into the ground, and immediately it budded with beautiful flowers that bloom every Christmas day. And so St. Joseph's thorn to the present day blooms on Christmas in Glastonbury, and slips of this plant, of course, have been sent all over the world. That's legend. The Bible tells us the truth about this man, Joseph of Arimathea, a good man, a member of the Sanhedrin, a just man, an honorable man. Now, it was the custom of Rome not to remove the bodies from the cross. When they crucified a man, they would just leave his body on the cross to be devoured by the dogs and the vultures. But Joseph of Arimathea went to Pilate and begged for the body of Jesus. We are told in John's Gospel that Nicodemus, a ruler of the Jews who had come to Jesus by night early in the ministry of Jesus, and questioned him concerning the way of salvation, the one that Jesus told he had to be born again, the one that Jesus told that God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. Nicodemus had come with myrrh and aloes, and together with Joseph, they wrapped the body of Jesus in these, swaddled the body with this linen, putting in it, of course, the myrrh and the aloes. Mark's gospel tells us that he went boldly and begged for the body of Jesus. It's interesting to me that though Joseph of Arimathea was a secret disciple of Jesus during the life of Jesus, that when Jesus was now dead, having been crucified, he no longer is a secret admirer. He boldly comes to Pilate and begs for the body of Jesus. I'm also interested and rather surprised that none of the disciples are named as helping him in the task of taking the body of Jesus down from the cross and preparing it for burial. That sort of shocks me. That the disciples, it seems, have all forsaken him and fled. But here comes this man, Joseph of Arimathea, who had only been a secret disciple of Christ up to this point, but somehow in watching and seeing the death of Jesus, became convinced more than ever that he was the disciple and was the Messiah, and he desires now to give to him an honorable burial, not allowing his body just to be devoured by the vultures, but he wants to take the body, and he begs Pilate for the body of Jesus. I think that one of the tragedies of life is that we have oftentimes the custom of honoring the dead. But in a sense, that's really too late. You know, we have a custom of sending flowers to the funeral to show our love and to show, you know, our appreciation. But how much better it would be if we would send the flowers before they die. Now, don't send me any flowers because I'm going to be a while yet, but better that they send the flowers before they die to express yourself, your love, your appreciation for the person before they die. There is a, in the South, they have interesting hymns. They have interesting hymnals. They have shape notes, and things are just different down in the South. They have a lot of what they call the Stamps Baxter songs. That was a quartet that was quite famous in years gone by, and they made a tremendous influence upon the singing in the South. And when I was down in the South preaching in some evangelistic services, I picked up one of these Southern hymnals. And of course, there seems to be a lot of sentiment in their songs. The titles express a lot of sentimental things. And I noticed the title of one of the songs, it was Tell Them Now They Can't Read Their Tombstones When They're Dead. The idea is expressing while the person is still alive your love for them, how much you think of them, how much you appreciate them. And it is rather sad and pathetic that oftentimes we don't bother to tell a person how much they mean to us while they're still alive. But when they're dead, then we sort of go around mourning, oh, you know, I wish I'd told them how much I love them, how much they mean to me, how much I appreciated all that they did. Joseph of Arimathea did not really stand up for Jesus. In fact, when they voted in the Sanhedrin concerning Jesus, when the high priest said, "What say ye of him?" With one consent, they all responded, "Let him be crucified." Oh, if Joseph had only spoken up then with Nicodemus and said, "Wait a minute. This man is innocent of these charges. Why should we crucify him?" But no dissenting vote. Secret disciple. But probably the fact that Jesus was now crucified, like so many people, once that person who has impacted their life so tremendously has died, then there is that, oh, if I'd only, oh, I should have, oh, you know. And so he comes now and boldly begs Pilate that Pilate would allow him to take the body of Jesus. Now, Pilate was surprised to hear that Jesus was already dead. He wasn't sure. And so he sent a centurion to check. And the centurion affirmed, yes, he is dead. And so Pilate granted to Joseph to take the body of Jesus. And so he took the body of Jesus down from the cross, we read. I love it. The fact that the body of Jesus after his death was only touched by those who loved him. Again, though, it's interesting to me that the disciples weren't there. The conspicuous absence of the disciples at this time. We're told he wrapped the body in linen, put a napkin over his head, wrapped the body in linen. The spices were wrapped within the linen, the 100-pound weight, he said, of the myrrh and alloys. And the purpose of the spices was to keep the odor from becoming too offensive of the decaying body. And this all seemed to be sort of a temporary exigency. Get it done before it gets dark. And then the idea was, after the Sabbath, we will come back and we will really embalm the body for burial. But just right now, get it wrapped, get it with the myrrh and the alloys, get it wrapped, and then we'll observe the Sabbath. And the whole thing was a hurried up thing because this day was the preparation day for the Sabbath in which no work could be done. Now, always for the Sabbath. Well, we're jumping ahead of ourselves just a little bit. It reads, he laid it in a sepulcher that was hewn from stone. Wrapped it in linen, laid it in a sepulcher. Jesus was not buried in a cave. That is a natural cave. It was a sepulcher that had been cut out of the rock. Now, over in Jerusalem today, there are many sepulchers that were cut right out of the rock. One of the most impressive sepulchers in Jerusalem is a few blocks away from the Garden Tomb. It is called the Tomb of the Kings, an extremely elaborate sepulcher cut out of the rock. A cistern has been created next to it. Steps going down, cut right out of the rock, and the cistern down at the bottom, which was to gather water for the gardens that were there. And oftentimes the wealthy people would have these elaborate sepulchers replete with gardens. And of course, to keep the gardens beautiful, the cisterns for the water supply for the gardens. It was a common practice among the wealthy. And this King of the Tombs is one of the classic sepulchers. And as you go down in, down these many steps carved out of the rock, and the whole area has been carved down out of the rock, it must have been an immense project. You go through the wall there, through this gateway or archway in the wall, and then you come into the area where the garden was and the sepulchers. And the interesting thing, of course, the king's tomb still has the rolling stone that has been rolled back so that you can go in with candles and you can see all of the niches in the sepulcher there where people have been buried. But it gives you the classic example, not natural caves, but sepulchers that were cut right out of the rock. And so Joseph, being a rich man, we are told that it was his own sepulcher. It was one that he had made for himself, hewn out of the rock. And according to John's gospel, it was in a garden. Now near the place where Jesus was crucified, there was a garden. And in the garden, a sepulcher in which no man had ever been placed. And Joseph buried Jesus in this sepulcher, hewn out of the rock in the garden right near the place where he was crucified. That is why it is my opinion that the garden tomb is probably the actual sepulcher where Jesus was buried, because it is just right adjacent to Golgotha, and there are cisterns there in the area of the tomb, which would indicate that there was a garden there, and the cisterns, of course, were to collect the water to water the gardens that were there. Now we read, and that day was the preparation, and the Sabbath drew on. According to Jewish law, you're not to do any work on the Sabbath day. Things shut down on the Sabbath. The wives do not cook any food because you cannot kindle a fire. And thus, the day before the Sabbath is the day of preparation. In the afternoon or all day long, most of the time, the Jewish women spend their day Friday cooking all of the food for the Shabbat meal, which is Friday night, and then cooking enough food and all so that the next day, all of the food will just be prepared and ready to eat. You don't have to do any preparation. All of the food is fixed and prepared because they were not to do any work on the Sabbath day. Thus, it did necessitate preparation for the Sabbath always. The preparing in advance, making sure that everything was all set so that when the Sabbath day came, you didn't have to do any work. Everything was just already set and you just lay around, rest and relax and have a time of family interaction on the Sabbath day. I think it is a tremendous program. I wish that we in the church would observe a Sabbath like that. I think it would be great for the family to just have a day where you do nothing but just enjoy the family. They don't watch television. They don't turn on the radio. They don't turn on record players. It's a day for just rest and relaxation, just casual. No dishes to be done. You wait. They all are just set there, and you wait to do them until the Sabbath is over. I mean, it's just a day of family togetherness, sharing time, the Sabbath day. And so this was the day that they were preparing for the Sabbath, which would begin, of course, at sundown. Now, John's gospel tells us that this particular Sabbath day was a high day. Now, when God gave the law of the Passover, it was to begin on the 14th day of the first month at evening. And that day was a day of a holy convocation, the 14th day and the 20th day were both days of holy convocation in which they were to do no work. It was to be as a Sabbath day. The rules of the Sabbath applied on the first day of the Passover and the last day of the Passover feast. Now, this particular Sabbath day was a high Sabbath day. It was possible that during the time of the Passover, you could have two Sabbath days running consecutively. Say that the 14th of the month fell on a Thursday, on a Friday. That Friday would be a Sabbath day, and of course, then Saturday would be a Sabbath day, and thus on Thursday evening, you'd have to do enough preparation to get you through 2 days because both days would be Sabbath days and there would be no work done during both Sabbath days. But it was possible, according to how the calendar went, to have two Sabbath days in a row, or quite often two Sabbath days within the same week. Days of without work, days of commemoration, days of recognizing God, days that would be holy unto the Lord, holy convocation. Now, there are some problems with Jesus eating the Passover supper with his disciples. Because that would have been on the Sabbath day. So they would not have had the meeting. They would not have crucified him all. They would not have had the trial and everything. It would have been the holy day of the Passover. And this day was the day of the preparation for this high day, which would, of course, been the actual beginning of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. In John's Gospel, it would seem to indicate that Jesus had the Last Supper with his disciples before the Passover feast. For you remember, in the 13th chapter, when Jesus was having the Last Supper with his disciples, and he announced that one of them would betray him, he turned to Judas Iscariot and he said, "What you do, do quickly." And Judas went out from the supper, you remember. Now it says that the other disciples really didn't know what Judas went out for. They thought that Jesus sent him out to buy some food and all for the Passover feast. For the feast. They thought that he had sent him out to get food for the feast because Peter had the bag. He was the treasurer. He had the money. And they figured Jesus just sent him out to get some food for the feast, which would have been the Passover feast, indicating that he probably had observed early this Last Supper with his disciples. It was the time of the Passover was coming. He sent the disciples to prepare things for the Passover meal. He said, "With desire, I've desired to eat this Passover with you before I die." But it would seem that he did observe it early with his disciples, that the Passover didn't come until the day after his crucifixion, that the day he was crucified was actually the day of the preparation for the Passover. Also, it being the high day or the holy convocation, it was not necessarily a Saturday Sabbath. It could very well have been a Friday Passover day and a Friday Sabbath followed by the Saturday Sabbath. Now, one of the reasons why I point this out is that though traditionally the church observes what we call the Good Friday, it takes a bit of mathematical juggling to have Jesus crucified on Friday, taken off the cross Friday afternoon, and placed in the tomb, and then spend 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth and be out of there by Sunday morning. If you go to add things up, it doesn't quite add. It's awfully hard to get 3 days and three nights. And yet Jesus said, when they were asking for a sign, that the sign that would be given to them would be the sign of the prophet Jonah, for as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the fish, so shall the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. Now, you can, I guess, and the Bible expositors have done their best to squeeze 3 days and three nights between Friday in the night and Sunday morning, but I find it hard to, it doesn't work on my calculator. But if as is perhaps suggested by John's gospel, if the Last Supper took place, say, on the 13th, the beginning of the 13th, which would have been the evening, of Wednesday evening that he had the supper with his disciples, he was arrested Wednesday night or early Thursday morning, brought before Pilate Thursday morning, placed on the cross Thursday morning, and there died, spending Thursday night, Friday night, and Saturday night in the grave, being placed there on Thursday before the sun went down. You can get the 3 days and the 3 nights without any straining. It does work out quite logically. Now, I'm not really wishing to create any controversy. If you find that's very offensive to you, you've always celebrated Good Friday, and you don't care about counting 3 days and three nights, then that's fine. I'm not, you know, pushing anything on you. I'm only making suggestions. What I suggest is not totally without difficulties. But as far as I can see, it has less difficulties than him being crucified on Friday, and then 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth, and yet being out. And he was out of there by the time they got there on Sunday morning. He was already gone. How much before they arrived, we have no way of knowing, but he was gone by the time they got there. So I offer that as a suggestion. Now we are told that the women also, which came with him from Galilee, followed after, that would be after Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus, as they were carrying the body of Jesus, just this short distance from Golgotha round and down to the tomb that was there. As they were carrying the body of Jesus, these women who had come with him from Galilee, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of Joseph, Mary the mother of Jesus, the women, they followed after them and beheld the sepulchre and how his body was laid in it. They watched them lay the body in the sepulchre. They were interested in what they were doing with the body of Jesus. Now again, it is to me rather interesting that it says the women followed. Where were the disciples? Where was Peter? Where was John? Where was James? Where were the disciples at this point? The women. It seems that women are capable of deeper and truer and more heroic devotion than men. When the men had fled the scene, the women were still there. When the men had been unfaithful, the women remained faithful, following, observing, watching, concerned. I love the impracticability of a woman's love, the illogic of a woman's love. I think probably one of the problems with men is they're too logical.
Women, they don't have to have logic. They're like,
Women, they don't have to have lunch. You say, well, he's dead. What difference does it make? Let's go. Can't do anything now. Come on, you know. Not a woman. I want to be there. I want to be close. I want to see what's going on. My wife has the capacity of praying for things I could never pray for. If the car battery is dead and it won't start, I can't pray, God help the car to start. Because I know the battery's dead. But that doesn't matter with my wife. And I can tell her, look, the battery's dead, honey. The car can't start. No sense praying for that. It's not logical. But she prays anyhow, and the car starts. Women don't have to have a reason. The impracticability of their love, the devotion. And here they are, still loving, though he is dead, still concerned, though he is dead, and still planning to honor and pay respects. For they watch to see where they put him and how they laid him there in the sepulcher. They observe that. And then what do? They go home. And rather than preparing for the Sabbath, they go home and prepare spices and perfumes and all, so that when the Sabbath is over, they can come back and they can again show their devotion by perfuming and taking care of properly. Now, not in a rushed, quick kind of thing, as they were quickly wrapping it up and quickly getting it set and all, because the Sabbath was approaching, the sun was going down. They had to get it all done. It was a quick, hurried up thing. But the women are going to come back when the Sabbath is over. They're going to do things right. And so they go home to make preparation for their return, in order that they might pay proper respect unto their Lord. And so they returned and prepared the spices and the perfumes, the ointments. They rested on the Sabbath day according to the commandment. And as we have suggested, perhaps two Sabbath days, which means they could not come back until the third day. But as soon as it was possible, upon the first day of the week, very early in the morning, they returned. And we'll get to that in our next lesson.